Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to run through a few quicker news stories and a question as well from listener. But we want to start up with something which has been taking up a lot of our attention from over the water in Alabama in the United States, which is a ruling from the state Supreme Court that frozen embryos utilized in IVF treatment should be considered children under law and that someone could be held liable for destroying them, which has opened up a new front in the US battle over reproductive medicine, as the BBC News article says, but it's also had immediate impact in that lots of IVF clinics and treatment services in the state of Alabama have had legal advice that they should shut their doors, maybe temporarily, maybe forever, because of this update. Have you been following this story?
Yes. It has created a lot of interest and and concern, and perhaps it's just worth sort of stepping back a bit and talking about IVF before we come to this particular development. And this is something we've discussed several times, haven't we, on this podcast?
Yeah.
In vitro fertilization is a relatively common procedure in the UK and the USA and elsewhere, including in many low resource countries, it involves creating harvesting eggs from the mother and then fertilizing them with sperm. And so in the normal process, quite a large number of embryos are often created, anywhere between 3, 4 and 10 to 20. And the normal practice is to examine the embryos, to allow them to develop for a short time, and then to select one or two embryos, or occasionally three, and reinsert them back into the womb. And then the question comes, what you do with the so-called spare embryos? And you've got a limited number of options. One is that you can freeze them, and almost indefinitely they remain in suspended animation, with the idea that you could then reimplant them subsequently. Two, you can donate them. Embryo donation is well recognized to another couple and another woman who will then the embryo can be reimplanted in her womb. Three, you can do research, which would involve the destruction of the embryo. Or four, you could discard them. And in practice, in vitro fertilization in the UK, all of those options are carried out and are fundamentally legal.
And so this case in Alabama, it all arose because of a really unusual court case where several years ago, a patient at an IVF clinic somehow managed to get into a storage room where frozen embryos were being kept. And they picked up some of the storage containers and then dropped it, which accidentally destroyed the embryos inside. And then the would-be parents of those embryos that had been destroyed then sued the clinic under a law in Alabama called the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act, which allows the parents of a child who dies to claim punitive damages and compensation. And after several legal appeals to and from, it reached all the way up to the state Supreme Court, which, drawing on other Alabama laws, which have already stated that unborn children should be considered to be children, concluded, therefore, that the wrongful death of a minor lawsuit could proceed because even embryos frozen after a few days of life in suspended animation in an IVF clinic would be legally counted as children, and therefore the would-be parents of them have the right to sue under the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act.
Yes. So, of course, once you've defined effectively an embryo as a child and that it has the same kind of legal protections as a child, then doing anything which might result in the death of the embryo becomes a very, very serious criminal offence. And it's not surprising that this has immediately led to fertility clinics in the state of Alabama becoming increasingly concerned about what the legal implications would be for them. Merely failing to implant an embryo and failing to freeze it could be regarded as leading to the death of a minor.
Yeah, and so most of the clinics in the state have actually stopped offering their services. And there's actually a really interesting long BBC News article where they speak to lots of infertile couples that were kind of days away from their first appointments, having taken the drugs that kind of stimulate ovulation for months and months, when suddenly it's all being kind of left up in the air. So it's having an immediate kind of pastoral impact on a large number of couples, but is also obviously kind of rippling out in the kind of cultural, social, political consequences as well.
Yes, and I mean, there are all kinds of interesting and strange aspects, aren't there, about this, that there's the unintended consequences. I'm sure that the people who undertook that original legal action against the fertility clinic hadn't really thought through what the potential consequences, you know, might be across the entire state, including for lots of other couples. And so it's just a further illustration, which we, as if we need more illustration, of the fact that the law is a very blunt instrument, that and that changing the law concerning issues at the beginning of life and often very contested and controversial issues at the beginning of life can have massive unintended consequences on people's lives. And I'm very sympathetic to the sort of levels of outrage and concern that are being expressed. And yet it does force one to reconsider and think through, doesn't it, what is the status of the embryo?
Yeah, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, so we don't want to necessarily retread over too much of the same ground, but what it throws up for me is this interesting or potential kind of tension in how a lot of Christians approach the status of the embryo, because, you know, the state of Alabama is a Republican, conservative-leaning state, and, you know, its Republican-controlled legislature, I think, for a while has had laws on the books which are kind of being drafted as an anti-abortion measure. I think even before Roe versus Wade was actually overturned, they had had like preemptive language in there on the statute books just waiting, which defines unborn children, embryos, as children, and therefore makes abortion impossible or much, much harder with more restrictions. And at the same time, no one who wrote those laws or the people who voted into power, the Republican legislators who passed the laws, had any intention that this would be applied to fertility treatment. And it has not been until suddenly the judges in the Supreme Court were asked the question and they concluded, well, if we say that life begins at conception when you're in the womb, why would that be any different if you're in a test tube in an IVF clinic. The location of that embryo shouldn't affect its status. And the BBC article is really interesting because lots of the couples, the infertile couples they interview, are themselves Christians who express anti-abortion perspectives, but are kind of horrified to discover that a kind of consequence of that has led to them being unable to access fertility treatment.
Yes, and I've been aware of this sort of contrast between attitudes to abortion and attitudes to IVF for, you know, for decades, because when I first wrote the first edition of Matters of Life and Death, a book on these kind of issues, which was 1997, I think, 96, 97, it was already very obvious that there was a big divide in opinion, and that many Christians were very strongly in favour of in vitro fertilisation. They saw this as a great example of using healthcare for good, to bring new lives into the world, to help couples who were infertile. And they saw that whole process as very different from the process of abortion and, you know, the deliberate taking of a life of an unborn baby in the womb. And of course, there are very, very marked ethical differences. But it is interesting to me, having been involved in debates, including public debates and media programs and so on for many years on these subjects, is that so many of people's ethical views are really generated by deep emotional intuitions. They're not based on careful and rigorous thought. It's just almost, it's derided as being, quotes, the yuck factor. It's, you know, do I have an immediate emotional response? So I know from my experience that if I'm trying to defend either the rights of newborn babies or mature fetuses, I know that the great British public by and large will be on my side, saying, oh, look at the little darlings. No, you mustn't do anything to them. Of course, they're precious. Whereas if I'm trying to promote the protection and defense of human embryos, you know, it's a lost cause. People look at you and they say, yeah, but they're just in a test tube. I mean, how can you get excited about that? Why should we worry about what's going on inside a test tube? So there is this very deep intuition, which isn't really based on a rational understanding, but it's very powerful. And so you can see how it's operating in this case, how the intuitions are that protecting embryos is really no significance, whereas protecting babies and unborn babies is.
Yeah. I mean, you see that really clearly. There's this woman called Margaret Boyce who's been quoted in the BBC piece, who describes herself as a devout Christian, but says she can't comprehend the decision. God, she says, tells you to go forth and be fruitful and multiply. You know, she's fundamentally, you know, the ethics, the unspoken ethics there is that, you know, God is pro-life, abortion is anti-life, and IVF is pro-life, and therefore IVF must be fine. She says, you know, nobody understands more that an embryo is not a child than the person yearning for that embryo to be a child.
Yes, and it is interesting that this general idea that you start with something that has no moral value as an embryo, and then as it gradually grows in the womb, it becomes more and more significant and more precious until you have close to term, when you have something which is uniquely precious and to be defended at all costs, like a newborn baby. And so this kind of moral development, a kind of progressive, gradual growth in value as this being develops in the womb, it's very common to hear people say that. Intuitively, it makes sense. The difficulty is that it's virtually impossible to provide any rational, philosophical, or theological justification for your moral value, starting from zero and slowly growing as every millimetre of size increases. I mean, we don't think that just because you're over 6 foot, you know, and a baby's only, you know, a sixth of your length, that doesn't mean that you have six times the moral value of a newborn baby.
No. I suppose the counter argument would be that, as we've discussed before, you know, a lot of this discussion comes down to people try and nail down when does life begin? You know, is it at conception? Is it at birth? Is it somewhere between the two? Whereas actually maybe the unspoken ethic here is that there is no, it's an evolutionary rather than a revolutionary process. It doesn't happen in an instant. It's a gradual accumulation of the status of personhood and life. And therefore it's definitely not human at conception, and it definitely is at birth. And rather there being a point between the two where we say, and now suddenly this is a full human being with all the rights it drives, that can gradually develop, and therefore at so and so weeks it will have certain rights and protections and dignities, and so weeks it will have a few more until it matures at 40 weeks to be considered the equal of you or I.
Well, and that is what is often suggested, but it doesn't fit with the psychology. I mean, we did a program not long ago about baby loss week, and this was talking about even very early miscarriages, where the emotional effect for some mothers and fathers was absolutely devastating, losing their baby, quotes, at 6 weeks. You know, this is something that has enormous value. And the fact that someone else has come along and says, oh, get real, we're talking about someone that was only 6 millimeters or a centimeter, you know, that's not going to wash very well with parents who feel this devastating loss of a child, an unborn child. So I think it doesn't work even at that intuitive emotional level. And it's very difficult to understand that theologically. You know, what we know about this being in the womb, and of course the absolute most extraordinary example is of this the meeting between the pregnant Mary and the pregnant Elizabeth, recorded in the first chapter of Luke, because it's really a meeting between the unborn Jesus and the unborn John the Baptist. And the extraordinary thing is that John the Baptist leaps for joy at the presence of Jesus. And Elizabeth, filled by the Spirit, says, how can it be that the mother of my Lord has come to me? And yet my Lord is about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks gestation. In other words, is a few millimeters in length. But the scriptural implication is not that, well, he's a sort of partway, just
demi-human.
About demi-human, let alone demi-god. He's my Lord. And John the Baptist is leaping for joy at his presence in mother's womb. So the scriptures really don't support this idea that of a sort of gradual growing value and significance. And so that has led me to feel, therefore, yes, we don't know for sure what the status of this being is, but we should play safe. If our response to uncertainty is to say that we shouldn't choose deliberately to destroy these beings. So therefore, I do believe that we shouldn't support procedures which are deliberately designed to destroy human embryos.
And to put you on the spot, would that include traditional IVF, where you're creating 8 embryos in the full knowledge that only 2, maximum 4, if you do a second round, will ever be implanted?
Well, I feel deeply uncomfortable about that, yeah, personally. I'm not in any sense being critical. I know that other Christians, many who I know, have undergone IVF. I know that some Christian ethicists have supported the whole procedure and have come to a different conclusion. I, in private conversation with couples who've been discussing this, have recommended, if they really want to go for IVF, they should go for a situation where you only create two or three embryos and you implant those immediately. And then you don't have the problems of the frozen embryos. You don't have the problems of what are we going to do with all these spares. I think that's ethically preferable, but I can understand other people that have come to different conclusions.
Hmm. So returning to the Alabama ruling, if we accept as a premise for now that the state of Alabama has democratically decided that it will ascribe personhood to the unborn child from the point of conception, do you think the ruling therefore is correct to say that in that framework IVF can't happen in the way it traditionally happens? That is a contradiction of laws that Alabama has already adopted.
Well, I think, you know, and this comes back to this, the law is a very blunt instrument for trying to work out complex moral judgments about the status of life and what kind of procedures should be allowed within a democratic society. And it's particularly complex in the States, isn't it, where you have this very, very strong polarization and culture war. And on both sides, the battle is so often about the law. It seems that, you know, where is the culture war being enacted? It's being enacted in Supreme Courts. That is principally the battle, is all about what the laws should have. And I find myself really out of sympathy with that, because I don't believe law is the main way in which Christians can have an influence in society by fighting and demanding for changes in law. I think the way that we act as salt and light in our society is in persuading, demonstrating alternative ways, showing a better way to live. And to assume that our primary role is to fight for judicial power and control is something that I personally find quite difficult.
Hmm. So you think, you know, obviously that impinges on the abortion discussion hugely, but do you think, again, for Christians thinking about IVF and fertility treatment, a better way forward is to try and engage couples experiencing infertility, hearts and minds, and talk to them about the realities and the consequences of their decisions, rather than trying to legislate out of existence, intentionally or unintentionally, all these IVF clinics, which really, if we're honest, has the effect of just forcing Alabamians who are already spending tens of thousands of dollars on the IVF to throw in another few thousand dollars to travel out of state to do it next door.
Absolutely. And, you know, this phenomenon of reproductive tourism, it's not just traveling into the States. There are places around the world, clinics around the world.
We discussed that around surrogacy a lot, didn't we?
Yeah. We discussed that. So this whole phenomenon of reproductive tourism shows that there is a demand, and people will follow the demand. So, yes, how do we change attitudes? And one of the sad things about the whole development of IVF is that there's very little incentive for doctors to try to improve the fertility, the natural fertility of couples. And this always saddens me, that because IVF is so financially successful, if a couple go to see a gynecologist because of infertility, they'll have a few baseline tests. And if nothing shows up, they will then just be referred straight to the IVF clinic. Whereas there is some evidence that shows if you do really detailed medical examination and then intervene to try to maximize the hormonal condition, to maximize the number of viable sperm and egg and all the rest, actually there's quite a strong evidence of successful pregnancy just coming from improving natural fertility. And that seems to me so much more appropriate from a Christian point of view, encouraging the body's normal function without having any of the kind of ethical problems that IVF raises.
Hmm. Yeah, that does seem wise. I mean, even up to the point of, I think you mentioned in previous podcasts, you can even do kind of in-womb IVF or something like that, isn't it?
That's also true. You can put the sperm and the egg directly into the womb and encourage implantation that way, or at least into the vagina. So there are a number of other techniques which don't involve the expense, the ethical problems, and so on. I would certainly want to encourage that. And I would also want to encourage a kind of positive attitudes to adoption and to other ways. You know, again, we've talked before, haven't we, in a society where there are so many unwanted children, so many children who desperately would want to have a family, it seems sad that we've then got this other extraordinary amounts of money and so on being expended to try to have a child who is genetically related to me.
Hmm. And just lastly on this then, do you think it's also, this is a kind of a shot across the bows, if you were, of the conservative Christian movement, kind of anti-abortion movement in general, which says actually pursuing this culture war through legal means is going to have a whole heap of unintended consequences? I mean, we've seen that elsewhere with Roe v. Wade, didn't we? This long cherished dream of the kind of religious right in the States has finally been achieved. They got enough Supreme Court justices to overturn Roe versus Wade, and it had the effect of there are lots of conservative states that have now banned abortion, but paradoxically it's also reinvigorated and re-energized the pro-choice lobby. And there is even now discussions about passing a federal law in Congress that would guarantee the right to an abortion as an alternative route. And there's also been kind of backlashes in several Republican states. They've seen some lawmakers lose their seats because there's a kind of hidden numbers of people who were, you know, broadly speaking, kind of pro-life, but thought the kind of state laws had been too strict. So pursuing these things through legal means often unspools in unpredictable ways that can have quite contradictory unintended consequences.
I'm afraid that's absolutely right. And just at a very sort of simplistic level, so far my understanding is there is no strong evidence that the total number of abortions in the US has changed. So there is this symbolic victory, as you say, which has been triumphed as an enormous advance, but actually the total number of abortions is relatively speaking unchanged, and then this seems like a Pyrrhic victory, isn't it? It seems rather hollow if the motivation is to try to reduce the number of abortions and protect unborn children. I think it's just a demonstration that law is a very blunt instrument. And I, for one, find that the slogan that says our goal is not to make abortion illegal, it is to make it unthinkable. In other words, it is about changing attitudes, social attitudes, moral attitudes, attitudes towards children, attitudes towards pregnancy. These things can change, they do change. And that seems to me a much more positive strategy that we should be trying to engage in our society, changing attitudes rather than this very blunt and often counterproductive effect of using law.
And I guess for those of us outside of the specific context of the southern United States, perhaps one of the only places on earth where kind of pro-life Christians have enough political capital to actually enact legal change. You know, for us here in the UK, for example, evangelicals are never going to be numerous enough, and, you know, without some kind of amazing revival to outlaw abortion. So our only real avenue for change is to pursue that kind of social cultural advocacy.
Yes, I do want to say that law is not completely irrelevant. And it just so happens that here in the UK, it's likely that we're going to have a debate in the House of Commons about changes to the abortion law, And I have been involved behind the scenes talking to MPs and supporting an amendment which would reduce the time limit for abortions from 24 weeks to 22 weeks on the basis of the improvement in survival of premature babies. Now, obviously, it's a small change. It represents a small number of people every year. But nonetheless, I personally, because this is my direct area of knowledge and expertise, feel that that's part of my role as a Christian to be involved in the political process. So there is a place to be involved and to try and persuade and encourage people in an appropriate direction, but it's not our main role. Our main role, it seems to me, is acting as salt and light within society and trying to encourage and change attitudes.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Shall we move on to another question from a listener? This came in from a listener called Alice, and it was responding to an episode we released a few weeks or maybe a month ago about the kind of gender gap in church, the idea that there are more women than men in most congregations or on average. And Alice says this: there were bits of the most recent episode that came across as suggesting that women are attracted to a soft and cuddly Christianity, whereas men are not. I do not fit that cliche. I too would be unimpressed by being gifted a journal at a weekend away, and I'm not a fan of women's events. It is not just men who struggle with this. This is not a gender issue. It is a too comfortable in the West issue. I don't think it was intended to come across this way, but it felt a little like women were lacked the courage to preach a gospel. It felt a little bit like women lacking courage and preaching a gospel of satisfaction. How do you respond to those charges?
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to have to say humble pie and apologize to Alice and to other listeners who I may have inadvertently offended by implying that men are incredibly, you know, like challenge and adversity,
adventure,
and that women don't. And I apologize for these if that was the impression given, because, you know, it's obviously the case that that's not true. And it is interesting, isn't it? If you look in the history of Christianity, it's so often been women who have taken the most dangerous pioneering roles. And in fact, I've just suddenly thought of a classic example, which is at the time of the cross, at the time of when Jesus was betrayed. You know, it's something that really struck me recently when I was writing about friendship, that in the upper room, Jesus says to these guys, I no longer call you my servants, I call you friends. And in the context, particularly in the biblical context, friendship is about covenant loyalty. It is the worst thing you can possibly do in friendship is to betray your friend. In fact, you know, earlier on in John's gospel, he says, you know, greater love has nobody than they lay down their life for their friend. In other words, that's what friendship is all about. So having told these 11 men, because Judas has just left, that he's going to be called friends, what happens to the 11 men literally within hours? They're all running scared, and they abandon Jesus to his fate. But there's an interesting subversive subplot to the gospel accounts, and that is, it turns out that Jesus does have loyal friends, and it's all the women.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the women who take the risk of going to the cross, even though that's an extremely dangerous thing. It's the women who watch where Jesus is buried. It's the women who prepare spices on Saturday. It's the women who go to the tomb first thing on Sunday morning. And it's the women who are the principal witnesses to the resurrection. So who were the loyal friends? Who were the courageous ones in all that scenario? And it wasn't the blokes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this kind of comes back to something, a point I think I was trying to make in that discussion, which is that so much of the conversation about the gender gap in church focuses on, you know, what are women doing wrong, or it's to make church so inhospitable to their brothers in Christ, when actually you could flip it around and say, why are so few men being prepared to pick up their cross and follow Jesus like their sisters in Christ are doing, like their mothers and their daughters and their sisters and aunts are doing? And what is it that men lack? A courage, commitment, a faithfulness, a bravery in our secular age when it's harder than it's ever been before to be a follower of Jesus, that leads to them wussing out and deciding to stay at home on a Sunday and not come to church, whereas their wives faithfully turn up, you know. And I think that's also a reductive approach to it, but I'm saying that's just as consistent with the data as saying Christianity has got too feminized and that's why men don't show, women have taken over church.
I think it is, but I suspect that question is a much better question than the question of has Christianity become over feminized. It is why are so many men voting with their feet? And I still don't really know the answer to that. It remains a mystery. And in particular, is it something about the human condition? I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, that there are churches in the UK that are well known to be attractive to a certain kind of man. And it'd be interesting to try to work out, you know, are there cultural and other factors? I suspect quite a lot of it is where my mates go. Yeah. You know, there's a kind of critical mass, isn't it? And men are often like that. I'm just not prepared to go myself. But if all my mates go, okay, I'll come along, because it's quite good to be along with my mates. So, and if church can have a kind of critical mass. But on another point of view, you could say that's pretty pathetic, isn't it? If that's the only reason why someone doesn't go to church, because I haven't got enough of my mates, I feel very, very insecure without lots of mates.
Yeah, hiding in the crowd. And I think you have to look at it in the context of, it's not just churches that are struggling at this, you know. There's been a collapse in attendance at lots of other previously male-dominated spaces. I'm thinking of trade union membership, you know, sports teams. If you know, there's a lot of sociological research has seen that, you know, in the post-war era, there's been this collapse in a lot of these institutions, which previously would see men, you know, even look at the closure of pubs and people, you know, previously, you know, the kind of high cathedrals of male culture of Britain was going in the of an evening, leaving the wife and kids behind at home and going to have a drink with your mates. And yet some ridiculous stat, like every week, two pubs shut down in Britain because there's not enough people.
I've never heard the King's Head pub described as the high cathedral. This is a...
But you see what I'm saying is there is a deeper vein of atomization and individuality and a turning away from these kind of communitarian collective experiences that I think if you look at the conversation about church attendance and don't look at it in isolation from these other social trends, you're probably going to draw some slightly speculative or erroneous conclusions.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Massive generalization alert and warning, but I wonder whether, I mean, everybody agrees that we're in a society where individualism in its different forms is rampant and where loneliness is increasing. And I just wonder whether men are more vulnerable to that as a massive generalization than women. And whether, you know, the loss of these cohesive communities is leading to male disengagement to a greater extent. And I mean, it's a hypothesis, isn't it? I think it's partly that, but I do think that many men are more attracted to non-relational activities, or at least, you know, I can go online and I can enter into this computer game environment, whatever it is, and I can become totally immersed there, and I'm really satisfied with that. Whereas I suspect that many women would just find that deeply unattractive and would prefer to spend time meeting up with friends and reaching out.
Yeah, and I think one of the few generalizations about the genders that we can actually point to significant amounts of research backing up is that generally women tend to rank higher in kind of pro-social measures when you know, you do kind of like psychological examination and studies. On average, women are more kind of pro-social than men. So I think it's that, and that often's true across times and across cultures. So I think clearly you can say that the communal experience of church is probably always going to be, all other things being equal, slightly more appealing to women because of the way they are wired than men. But of course, within those general trends, there are vast, vast variety, as Alice's question outlines in another angle.
Yeah. And actually, I would say it's not, I would describe it slightly differently. It's not that as a generalization, women are more pro-social than men. I think it's more that women have greater social competence. In other words, I hear a lot of men say something like, I would love to have more friends. I would love to spend, have deeper relationships and have better friendships, but I don't know how to do it. I really find it difficult. Whereas I think there are fewer women who would say that. I think the general levels of how do you develop a friendship? How do you nurture a friendship? How do you, that was why in my book, Friendship, you know, in the final chapter, I felt I had to just give some advice to the blokes, you know, which was as basic as, you know, why didn't you pick up the phone and say, would you like to meet up? And, you know, why didn't you talk about their interests and find something, you know? And, you know, somebody, a woman commented to me, you know, why on earth do you need to say that? You know, isn't that all blindingly obvious? And the point is, actually, you know, for some men, no, it isn't blindingly obvious.
Terrifying me. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we could probably talk about that for a lot longer, but we should probably draw it to a close before you accidentally offend half our listeners once more.
thanks offend for everybody Alice. Equally. That's my goal, is just as long as you offend everybody equally, it's not a problem.
An admirable strapline for any podcast, I'm sure. Equal offenders since 2020, whatever it was. Thank you, Alice, for your question. Thank you, everyone else who's been sending in questions. We'll try to do another episode tackling a few more of those soon. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. Particularly interested in your feedback to previous episodes, your disagreements, your criticism. It's good for us, for both our egos, to be told that we've dropped the ball or we've got something wrong. So please do feel free to chip in where we've done that. Don't forget, as always, you can have a look at lots of things to read and listen to and watch on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. But otherwise, we will be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.